All right, it's recording. We've been talking in the last class about the sort of theory of why this topic is important. Now I'm going to use this class to talk about the history to demonstrate how it gained importance historically. So this is sort of a few minutes, maybe 30 or 40 minutes on the history of this topic. It's pretty damn interesting. Because history, well, history should always be interesting to you no matter what. Because people that lived back in the 1800s and 1900s are just like you and me. They made the same stupid mistakes, so why should you make the same stupid mistakes again? You understand the history of HR, for example. Then you hopefully won't step into that same river again and make the same mistake. So, I'm going to talk to you about the history and hit some of the highlights that are important to you. I'm drawing circles now, not champagne bubbles. What this represents is villages here in the United States. In the, say, like 1820s, arriving from England, was the concept, in modified form, of employment at will. Employment at will was the way that the relationship between employer and employee was established in England. And what this meant was, back in the day, was that the employee could quit anytime they wanted, with one modification, and the employer could fire at any time they wanted. And this particularly applied to farm workers, generally speaking. You know, 80% of people were working on farms. And this relationship was essentially a two-way street in which either one could sever the relationship between employee and employer at will, right? However, there was one restriction. And that restriction was that an employee could not quit during harvest season. And that statement, the employee could not quit during harvest season, throws into the bucket of interesting facts something that should shape your knowledge base for the rest of your life. Who was advantaged by the fact that employees could not quit during harvest season? The employer was advantaged. Why? How, I guess, would be the better answer to the question. How was the employer advantaged by the restriction on the employee quitting during harvest season?
You could work them harder, they wouldn't quit.
You could work them harder and they wouldn't quit. You would get your harvest in without a problem. And the employee could not use this hectic season as a lever to demand
higher wages.
Yeah. Now, thinking about this again, you can see that the person who has the money here, the farmer who owned the farm, has the power, right? And this will come forward to the industry union battle right up until today's times when you see battles between companies trying to change laws, modify laws, and erode unions. As we know them now. So this concept of who has the power, and the power is almost always held by the person with the money, they buy the politicians, etc., and it's going to play out in the years to come in important considerations. But at the time, employment at will had shaped the employer-employee relationship. This came to the United States as a more straightforward statement of the relationship. And it came to the United States was known as termination at will. Pretty makes it a clearer statement, doesn't it? Who terminates? Does the employee ever terminate the employer?
No.
No. It's always the employer terminating the employee for some Teresa. And as it came to the United States, the general understanding of this term as litigated and interpreted by common law consideration in the courts was that the employer could fire for three reasons. One, good cause. Number two, bad cause. Three, any cause. So that established the relationship as it grew through the 1800s, on up into the 1900s, up into a past mid-century, and slowly became eroded to some degree, which we'll talk about. But the concept of termination at will gave essentially all the power to the employer. All right, so as this comes across, here's what it runs into. In these villages in, let's say, the early 1800s, late 1700s, each one of these villages had its own manufacturing, so to speak, process to put together the various needs for the village. If people needed barrels, they went to, I think they're called the Wainwrights. I'm not sure. If they needed leather products, they went to the, like, traces for your horse, you know, reins and bridles and saddles, that kind of stuff. They went to the cordwainers, right? If you went to the shoe, you wanted shoes, there was probably some term, but we can call them cobblers or shoemakers, et cetera, et cetera. Did any of you read Johnny Tremaine? No, not one stinking person here read Johnny. It's about a book for fourth graders, but it's all about a young kid who grows up in this system, which was known as the master and apprentice system. The master hired apprentices, kept them for 7 years, trained them into the new business, nothing personal, trained them into the new business, and after 7 years or so, they would graduate to be able to start their own business. And this relationship meant that you had skilled people working on shoes, took a while to build up, and that the shoes that you were having made were going to be custom built for you. My wife had custom built shoes made for her in Hong Kong for like $23 or something. And we made a number of trips on our bicycles across Shanghai, down through Shanghai, to eventually arrive at the little shoemakers, and she would have her foot measured and the straps tightened and lots of talk going on. They didn't speak English, and her Chinese was like zero ling. And so it took a while, but eventually her little shoe, her medium shoe showed up. All right, so this was the master and apprentice, somewhat inefficient, custom manufacturing of shoes, for example. And this is the way all this stuff was built. You needed a barrel, you needed leather for your horses, you needed a new pair of shoes, you know, you could have silver or what color you wanted them, whatever. And all this stuff was made for you the way you wanted them. All right, so this meets termination at will, meets one other factor. And that one other factor is that this whole process was about to change anyway due to the
Industrial Revolution.
Thank you, Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution meant that people were out and machines were in. So what you had here in the Industrial Revolution was a situation in which the large money holders, which is to say the landowners, built a factory, stuffed it full of newly developed machines, and those newly developed machines could take raw materials in, transform them through the machines with the help of people running the machines, and at the other side, thousands of shoes would come out, whatever it was that they were manufacturing, which of course lowered the fixed costs on these shoes and essentially made the pair of shoes a lot cheaper than they would have been made if they've been made in the old master and apprentice format. So, slowly but surely, people stopped buying, since we're on a shoe roll here, stopped buying shoes or barrels or leatherwork or whatever it might happen to be from the various local provider, and as the whole concept of factory manufacturing came in because of the Industrial Revolution, concurrently with the increase in infrastructure here, it meant that goods could travel much more easily than they could when these villages were much more isolated. So we had then the movement of goods across this new infrastructure being manufactured in factories, right, that were put up by people with money who were known as, isn't it interesting that the person that answered this question in my last class was my Chinese student? What would she say? Who put up the money for manufacturing? Who puts it up?
Capitalists.
She said it right away. Put up by the capitalists. So right you are. And you will not find any place more capitalistic than Shanghai, for example, or Nanjing. Don't go on, for God's sake. Guangzhou. It's all capitalist now. But anyway, sort of hidden a little bit. So the capitalists put up the money, put the machines in there, put people in there to run the machines. And where did they get the people, by the way? Yeah, from the villages, because nobody was buying the shoes anymore. So the master, the apprentices from all these places went to work at the local factory because they weren't getting anything anyway. Now, remember I said that the factories were being built by the capitalists, and the capitalists were taking their money to build these places and put the machines in place. And what did they respect for their investment?
Profit,
but there's a better word. You're right. Profit, money. But what's the actual word for invest that goes with investment?
Returns,
right. Returns. So we're looking for returns here. And when did they want those returns? Today? Next week? The 12th of never? The next eon? Or 2 days after I die? When did they want the returns?
Today.
Today! Or in fact, this minute, if they possibly could. They wanted the maximum return ASAP, which is a technical term meaning as soon as possible. So what we're looking at here is getting money out of this plant. And how did they do it? How did they do it? They bought cheap leather or whatever. They ran it 24 hours a day if they could, and they put hyper pressure on right. I sometimes draw a picture of a thumb pressing on a person like this. You know, work faster. Of course, working faster led to unfortunate mistakes. Oh, you cut your arm off. Sorry about that, you're fired. Et cetera, et cetera. So lots of pressure, lots of issues, unpleasant work conditions. That led the employees to say, bag this, we hate you. And the employees in the about 1840s and on, made high use of the process by which they became
unionized,
exactly. So, we have a unionized situation. I thought I would mention to you that I have a short, small hobby that sometimes I forget the components of. Causes of the Industrial Revolution, advances. That made the Industrial Revolution possible. You ready for some of them? They're really interesting, at least to me. My sister gave me one. She's an archaeologist. She's really cool. She teaches out at Chico. She said she has an archaeological thing she goes to, and she's been using a drone that flies over the site and takes movies, you know, takes video of the site. She said it's incredibly helpful because you can see all kinds of things you can't see at ground level. But that is irrelevant. She gave me one of the things. What were some of the things that helped the Industrial Revolution happen? What would you think?
Electricity.
No electricity then. They were using water power, right?
Steel.
Steel. What did they have before steel?
Iron.
Iron. What's the wear potential on iron?
Extremely high.
It's soft as any... Well, it doesn't feel soft if you happen to get hit by an iron bar, as my friend Reggie, the ex-janitor, now dead, told me. He got hit on the head with an iron bar when he was working on jukeboxes in Cincinnati or someplace terrible. Never quite recovered. Great guy, though. So, changing of iron into steel using coke and high-temperature furnaces. Do you know about this stuff or not? Mm. Yeah, me too. That's about the way I am. I just sort of bluff it by sort of running it across. The kids write it down and just forget it. Yeah, they're changing it with lots of heat, and they throw in some nickel into the iron, stir it around with a big spoon, and there's your iron or steel. Well, steel is one of them because it didn't wear out. You could make gears, right? Okay, what else do we have to have? Pardon?
The assembly line.
That became up with Ford, really. Ford was the assembly line. So that was a little bit later. I'm talking about more initial stuff.
Oil or grease?
Pardon?
Oil or grease to keep it lubricated?
I'd never thought of it. Possibly. Like wheels on a wagon, even then they would grease them. But they probably had it already. New technology, let's say. I think they had grease already, but I think you're right. I hadn't thought about it.
Interchangeable parts.
I think that's a Ford thing, too.
Ford?
I think so.
Cotton gin?
No. They wanted to drink? No. What? No. These are technological advances.
Right, the cotton gin. You take seeds out of cotton.
I know, but what are they going to do? How did...
Yeah.
That was an example, I guess.
Yeah, okay.
What I'm talking about is actual technology changes. What did they have in one of those plants? If you... I like the idea, though.
Yeah.
Eli Whitney?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, cotton gin. Why do they call it a gin?
That was the process of by which of pulling out the seeds. Apparently it was called ginning.
See, the things you learn are never wasted. Did you ever think you were going to use that in a class and get a gold star from your professor for knowing that? You probably never thought that. But see, there you go. You got to know everything in the end. And if you don't know, just come and ask me, I'll tell you. All right, so what we have is then... other things that could do it. All right. What do you see when you see old pictures of plants back in the 1850s? What did it look like in there? What did you see dominating? They had power, right, from the water wheel. But how did that power get hooked up to somebody's machine, you know, 50 feet away or 100 feet away? And what were on the pulleys? What were on the pulleys? Ooh, see, there you go. They were belts, but they were not made out of rubber.
They weren't leather.
Leather. And where did they get the leather? Aha! Another piece of trivia that you're going to love. They shot them off the plains, buffaloes. That's where they got the leather. They could not have come up with leather any other way in the quantity they needed except to kill off the buffaloes. Isn't that interesting? Do you think they killed buffaloes to wear the damn pelt or put it on a teepee in New York City? No. They wanted the leather for the belts for the machines. Cool, huh? All right. Now, in one of these plants, that's the second one. In any one of these plants, you can't have people sort of all showing up whenever they want. You want to say, everybody needs to be here at 8 o'clock, and sure, they could blow a whistle and this and that. But the employee would say, oh, I sound asleep, I couldn't wake up, and all of a sudden I heard the whistle, it was too late. What did they need to be able to do?
Standard
clocks, indeed, and standardizing time. So they had to invent a clock, which was, as you probably know, I hope you know, John Harrison in New York, in London, developed the clock in order to improve navigation on ships. And that clock works. Became part of the core necessity to have the Industrial Revolution work because people had to show up at the right time. And finally, this is the one my sister pointed out to me, and she's got two or three books to her name. If you ever want to know everything about tobacco and the history of tobacco, you can read about it in January. She's got a book coming out. Want to know about sugar? Her book's on that is already out. The whole history of sugar. Fascinating, to say the least. She's one of she's an underwater swimmer and finds stuff. She's really a scuba swimmer. It's really cool. She bought a Prius and she won't let me drive it. Every time I show up, Joey and I show up there, I say, oh, Georgia, I gotta drive the Prius. She, oh, sure, sure. By the time we leave, do you think I've driven it? That's weird. Your sister won't let you drive her car. Anyway, so she suggested the final piece of this, how the Industrial Revolution could happen. If you got a whole shipload of employees working, people come in out of these plants, come in off the farms, what are we missing that the employees and everybody else is going to need? Well, houses maybe we can get away with, but food. How did we feed these people when there was a limited number of farmers?
Mechanized farming.
Well, not yet. We had to have a crop that needed mechanized farming. And that crop came to us from Ireland.
Potatoes,
exactly. Potatoes fueled the Industrial Revolution, according to her, and she knows everything about this stuff. So isn't that cool? We got clocks, we got steel, we got taters, and we got buffaloes. Those are my list of four so far. I'll probably come up with more in the next 10 or 15 years. I'll send you an email. Pretty cool in any case. These things had to co-join at just the right time to make all this stuff happen. It's kind of neat. Okay, so the Industrial Revolution created these plants that created a bad work environment, so employees and employers hated each other, what I call a versus relationship, versus. So employees versus employers. And, as you can imagine, it was an inefficient process. People are looking to steal time by not working, the employer's trying to work people without paying them, and they're, in general, creates a bad relationship. And this was evident in the cars that were being made. Yes, we didn't know our elbow from a hole in the ground about how to make cars back in the 50s and 60s. We made them, but they sure as heck weren't very good. And they weren't much better than they were in 1890 when Benz came up with his car. So what we have then is an inefficient manufacturing with poor ideas creating this iron monstrosity, though often with big fins and painted with three colors. My grandmother had a Packard Caribbean. Had a big spare tire, what we used to call a Hollywood spare on the back, all the big bumper, a spare tire. Three color convertible. Three colors, pink, black, and white. So she was about 80 at the time. She'd be cruising around York, Pennsylvania in her Packard Caribbean with a top down. She was definitely the man. I mean, the grandmother. She looked cool, to say the least. That car was gorgeous for the day. Three colors. And how many of us have cars with over 100,000 on them, miles? Yeah. You know how many that would be in 1950? Nobody would raise their hand. If they did, it was because at 100,000 miles, the last 40,000 had been on a tow truck hook, and they dragged it the last 40,000. Because cars couldn't go more than about 60 or 80,000 miles before they hit their wear date. And so there's been a lot of improvements. Back in those days, though, really nobody cared. And why didn't they care?
Exactly.
That's a good way to say it. They didn't know any better. Every car that was available for them to buy, from Henry J's to Studebakers to Packards to whatever it was that they could buy, were all pieces of crap. And did they know it? No, because they had nothing to compare it to. 60,000 miles, I sure wouldn't walk 60,000. I'm glad I got a machine that does it for me. My other grandmother had a Cadillac with an automatic dimmer on it for the headlights. Big advance. The problem with the automatic dimmer was that it didn't really dim, it had an electric eye there, and it picked up the oncoming lights of the car, and then it said, okay, time to dim the lights, and it sent a signal down, the lights dimmed. Well, by the time all that happened, the car that was driving towards you was in the ditch or around a tree because they were blinded by your lights because you left them on high to the last possible minute. I mean, these people did not have their act together. I'm just thinking about weird things that cars could do. My brother is a mechanic, my little brother, not my older brother, who was a founder of Starbucks, for God's sake, can you believe it? Before it went public, he bought like a huge wheelbarrow load of stuff from them. because he knew Howard Schultz. Anyway, but my little brother fixes exotic cars. So one day he's in there at his shop out in Whidbey Island in Washington State. This guy pulls in a Land Rover. Matt hates Land Rovers. The guy says, it's making a lot of noise. Matt goes, yeah, tell me another piece of crap. And guy says, well, what do you think's wrong? And Matt says, I'll open the hood and take a look. You start it up. So Matt opens the hood, and he's looking in there. The guy starts it up, and he says, bam, 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 bam. So much noise. Matt says, shut it off. Shut it off. I found the problem. And the guy says, what is it? Out of the engine bay, my brother takes the piston and connecting rod in his hand and says, here's the problem. The piston, the connecting rod, had come out the side of the motor. We often wonder. Probably, I would say that, you know, the cap came off, freed up the connecting rod, the piston went berserk and just blew a hole in the side of the motor. I know. Isn't that great? That's a great story. Here's your problem. Straight face, completely, not even laughing, nothing. Here's the problem. It's pretty good. He works on exotics. It's great. Anyway, so cars were not very good in those days. Gas was cheap. Well, I can remember seeing it in 1909. So that was cheap. So you didn't really care how efficient your car was or this or that. You just drove it and put in 19-cent gas and this and that. I used to time it so when I took my grandmother to lunch, she bought me a Corvette, can you believe it, to take her to lunch on Sundays. She said, well, you have to have a car to take me to lunch on Sundays. What do you think you ought to have? I had an idea. A 63 Corvette. She said, okay, that's fine. And when I got it, she sat down and said, I like this car because the ashtray's right there where I can put my cigarette. You're the man, Granny. And she bought me gas every week, too. To fill that thing up cost about maybe 20 gallons, at 20, so about, you know, $3 or $4 to fill it, which was lucky because it probably got around 10 miles to a gallon as I drove the damn thing. Lost my license immediately upon getting that car, immediately. It did not advance to go. Anyway, so cars were cheap. They were not well made. Everything was cheap and nobody expected any more. Until what? This, by the way, I have a term for this. It's called common rule. Everyone was following the same rule. It's a good concept to think about. If everyone follows the same rule, and this rule happened to be inefficiency and versus relationship with employees, all the manufacturers had to do the same thing. And so nobody knew the difference. We built the cars, they were pieces of crap, and that was it. That common rule, which was accepted by the public because they didn't know any better, was broken in early 50s or so, mid-50s or so. What was it that broke the common rule? Of Japanese a little bit later, but yes, European cars first. My parents, my mom and dad, both had little Porsches. They were beautiful, fun cars. Not expensive then, by the way. They were just glorified VWs. And they were really fun little cars. I talked my mother into one when I was 17. It was great. And who smashed it up first? Who smashed my Porsche up first? My mother. That's mothers for you. But these cars came in and they were much higher quality coming from Europe. They were, you know, did you see the Woody Allen movie when the Volkswagen starts after 20 years? Well, that was one of, you know, he falls asleep on Quick Van Wrinkle and he wakes up and he goes out, his Volkswagen's in a cave somewhere covered with cars. He gets in, turns and starts. And, you know, that was sort of the image they had. That these cars were much better and of course more fuel efficient as gas prices went up, people started buying them, blah, 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 blah. That broke the common rule. In Europe, they didn't have this conflict between unions and management because union members sat on the board of directors in Germany for what they call co-determination, interestingly enough. And so the workers had say in what was going on. And they made sure that they were reasonably treated. Germany, for example, has, count them, 12 paid weeks of vacation. Yes, that's pretty good. It's like you retire. You're always retired, almost. So, yeah, it's a pretty good deal. So that broke the common rule. Decent cars come across. The Americans say, uh-oh, I got some problems. My car falls apart at 60,000 miles, where these little German and later Japanese machines run into the hundreds of thousands with no problems at all. So they started to tighten things up, and one of the first things they wanted to tighten up was the relationship between employers and employees. So human resources became important because of that reason, for one. Why were Japanese cars so much better over time than American cars? In fact, still better mechanically. Who was the influential person that shaped Japanese manufacturing? No, an American. No, interesting that this name is not discussed anymore.
MacArthur?
Begins with a D. No, it's an industrial engineer. A guy by the name of Deming, D-E-M-M-I-N-G. Deming created the process the Japanese use known as continuous improvement. Have you heard of the idea of continuous improvement? That's a Deming concept. He tried to sell it here in the United States, no interest. Why should we improve our cars if nobody cares? But he took the idea to Japan, where there's now a Deming Award each year for the company with the best product in its category. And so the Japanese cars that first came over were little rust buckets in the late 60s, early 70s. They rusted really badly, little Honda 500, et cetera.
Datsun.
We need to come up with a car. We got the car made, it's all designed. And the boss says, Datsun. That's how they got the name. See, Datsun. It's a joke. Sort of. And so they made cars that were much more attractive to people because they weren't found on road dead or fixed or repaired daily. Is there one of those things for Chevy? Doesn't say something like a piece of crap found on the road and who the hell would want to own one in the word Chevy? No? I tried. I couldn't think of it. So the common rule is broken. We begin to see that it's important to have a good relationship between the owners and the employees because the friction there creates an inefficiency. So that requires us, through human resource processes, to bring these two groups together. And along with that, in the mid-60s, we came up with all these various new laws that were to protect employees against pay issues, illegal discrimination, workplace safety, those kinds of things. All that required somebody who was reasonably expert, i.e. the human resources managers, expert to help the company navigate those problems. So human resources gained cachet, we would say, gained power, gained importance, where earlier they had no influence in the 40s and 50s, next to no influence. So that's where we are today. And that's enough for today. Go home, be safe, don't do anything stupid. Listen to the recordings for the next quiz, which you'll find on the S drive, right?
By the way, okay. One of the questions was asked me about the grand.